The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com, and that's spelled GSUGGS Insurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine did not publish last week, nor has it so far this week, so I will be reading from previous issues. The first article comes from the last issue, which we have at our disposal. That's August 31/September 7, 2020. The other articles will be coming from the previous issue, dated August 17/August 24, 2020. Beginning with the world, losing hope in India. Faced with a recession, a surging virus, and majoritarian rule, many people in the world's largest democracy are wondering how they will survive. By Billy Perigo, London, and Neha Tarani Bagri, Pune, India. With a white handkerchief covering his mouth and nose, only Rajkumar Prajapati's tired eyes were visible as he stood in line. It was before sunrise, August 5, but there were already hundreds of others waiting with him under fluorescent lights at the main railway station in Pune, that's P-U-N-E, an industrial city not far from Mumbai, where they had just disembarked from a train. Each person carried something, a cloth bundle, a backpack, a sack of grain. Every face was obscured by a mask, a towel, or the edge of a sari. Like Prajapati, most in the line were workers returning to Pune from their families' villages, where they had fled during the lockdown. Now, with mounting debts, they were back to look for work. When Prajapati got to the front of the line, officials took his details and stamped his hand with ink, signaling the need to self-isolate for 7 days. After Prime Minister Narendra Modi appeared on national television March 24 to announce India would go under lockdown to fight the coronavirus, Prajapati's work as a plasterer for hire at construction sites around Pune quickly dried up. By June, his savings had run out, and he, his wife, and his brother left Pune for their village 942 miles away, where they could tend their family's land to at least feed themselves. But by August, with their landlord asking for rent and the construction sites of Pune reopening, they had no option but to return to the city. "We might die from corona, but if there's nothing to eat, we'll die either way," said Prajapati. As the sun rose, he walked out of the station into Pune. And again, I may not be pronouncing this correctly. It is spelled P-U-N-E. The most infected city in the most infected state in all of India. As of August 18, India has officially recorded more than 2.7 million cases of COVID-19, putting it third in the world behind the U.S. and Brazil. But India is on track to overtake them both. "I fully expect that at some point, unless things really change course, India will have more cases than any other place in the world," says Dr. Ashish Jha, director of Harvard's Global Health Institute. "With a population of 1.3 billion, there is a lot of room for exponential growth." The pandemic has already reshaped India beyond imagination. Its economy, which has grown every year for the past 40, was faltering even before the lockdown, and the International Monetary Fund now predicts it will shrink by 4.5% this year. Many of the hundreds of millions of people lifted out of extreme poverty by decades of growth are now at risk in more ways than one. Like Prajapati, large numbers had left their villages in recent years for new opportunities in India's booming metropolises. But though their labor has propelled their nation to become the world's fifth largest economy, many have been left destitute by the lockdown. Gaps in India's welfare system meant millions of internal migrant workers could not get government welfare payments or food. Hundreds died, and many more burned through the meager savings they had built up over years of work. Now, with India's economy reopening, even as the virus shows no sign of slowing, economists are worried about how fast India can recover and what happens to the poorest in the meantime. The best-case scenario is 2 years of very deep economic decline, says Jayati Ghosh, chair of the Center for Economic Studies and Planning at Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi. There are at least 100 million people just above the poverty line. All of them will fall below it. In some ways, Prajapati, 35, was a lucky man. He has lived and worked in Pune since the age of 16. Though, like many laborers, he regularly sends money home to his village and returns every year to help with the harvest. Over the years, his remittances have helped his father build a four-room house. When the lockdown began, he even sent his family half of the $132 he had in savings. The $66 Prajapati had left was still more than many had at all, and enough to survive for 3 weeks. His landlord let him defer his rent payments. 2 weeks into the lockdown, when Modi asked citizens in a video message to turn off their lights and light candles for 9 minutes at 9 p.m. in a show of national solidarity, Prajapati was enthusiastic. Lighting small oil lamps and placing them at shrines in his room and outside his door, "We were very happy to do it," he said. "We thought perhaps this will help with Corona." Other migrant workers were not so enthusiastic. For those whose daily wages paid for their evening meals, the lockdown had an immediate and devastating effect. When factories and construction sites closed because of the pandemic, many bosses, who often provide their temporary employees with food and board, threw everyone out onto the streets. And because welfare is administered at a state level in India, migrant workers are ineligible for benefits like food rations anywhere other than in their home state. With no food or money, and with train and bus travel suspended, millions had no choice but to immediately set off on foot for their villages, some hundreds of miles away. By mid-May, 3,000 people had died from COVID-19, but at least 500 more had died distress deaths, including those due to hunger, road accidents, and lack of access to medical facilities, according to a study by the Delhi-based Society for Social and Economic Research. It was very clear there had been a complete lack of planning and thought to the implications of switching off the economy for the vast majority of Indian workers, says Yamini Iyer, president of the Center for Policy Research, a Delhi think tank. Although Indian policymakers have long been aware of the extent to which the economy relies on informal migrant labor, there are an estimated 40 million people who regularly travel within the country for work. The lockdown brought this long invisible class of people into the national spotlight. Something that caught everyone by surprise is how large our migrant labor force is and how they fall between all the cracks in the social safety net, says Arvind Subramanian, Modi's former chief economic advisor who left government in 2018. Modi was elected, that's M-O-D-I, was elected in 2014 after a campaign focused on solving India's development problems. But under his watch, economic growth slid from 8% in 2016 to 5% last year, while flagship projects like making sure everyone in the country has a bank account have hit roadblocks. The truth is, India needs migration very badly, Subramanian says. It is a source of dynamism and an escalator for lots of people to get out of poverty. But if you want to get that income improvement for the poor back, you need to make sure the social safety net works better for them. The wide-scale economic disruption caused by the lockdown has disproportionately affected women, because 95% of employed women work in India's informal economy. Many lost their jobs, even as the burden remained on them to take care of household responsibilities. Many signed up for India's rural employment scheme, which guarantees a set number of hours of unskilled manual labor. Others sold jewelry or took on debts to pay for meals. The COVID situation multiplied the burden on women, both as economic earners and as caregivers, says Ravi Verma of the Delhi-based International Center for Research on Women. They are the frontline defenders of the family. But the rural employment guarantee does not extend to urban areas. In Dharavi, a sprawling slum in Mumbai, Ramila Parmar worked as domestic help in three households before the lockdown. But the families told her to stop coming and held back her pay for the past 4 months. To support her own family, she was forced to take daily wage work painting earthen pots, breathing fumes that make her feel sick. People have suffered more because of the lockdown than because of corona, Parmar says. There's no food and no work. That has hurt people more. Girls were hit hard, too. For Ashwini Pawar, a bright-eyed 12-year-old, the pandemic meant the end of her childhood. Before the lockdown, she was an eighth-grade student who enjoyed school and wanted to be a teacher someday. But her parents were pushed into debt by months of unemployment, forcing her to join them in looking for daily wage work. My school is shut right now, said Pawar, clutching the corner of her shawl under a bridge in Pune, where temporary workers come to seek jobs. But even when it reopens, I do not think I'll be able to go back. She and her 13-year-old sister now spend their days at construction sites, lifting bags of sand and bricks. It's like we've gone back 10 years or more in terms of gender equality achievements, says Nitya Rao, a gender and development professor who advises the UN on girls' education. This page features a colorful photo. It's colorful in that there are contrasts. I'll read the caption first. Healthcare workers check a woman's temperature and oxygen saturation in a Pune slum, August 10. The ground looks earthen, and the ground is surrounded by an alleyway of dark places. I don't know if these are rooms or if it's even a structure. I see draperies hanging as if they were doors. I see a bright blue ladder on the back wall, which is also bright blue. I see a dull brown ladder in the foreground of the photo. It's not indicative as to where these ladders are leading, but this is a very narrow, dingy passageway. Also at the back by the blue wall is a very bright blue large drum or barrel. Behind that, there are things hanging, fabric, fabric items, brightly colored, hanging on the walls. There are pipes, which indicates some type of utilities, perhaps. I do not see any lighting except from directly overhead, ambient lighting, probably from the outdoors. There are three people pictured in this photograph. Two are apparently the healthcare workers. All are dressed in the beautiful, colorful garb of the Indian population. One is wearing a sari. She's wearing orange with a bright magenta, teal, and orange covering over it. I'm not sure if it's technically a sari, but it has that effect. She has long, straight black hair, and she's wearing a black mask. She's also holding a clipboard and has plastic gloves on her hands, and she has a pencil or pen, a writing implement, in one of her hands, her right hand. Opposite her is another individual. Now, I'm unable to determine whether this is male or female. It's probably female because she's wearing, again, a beautiful dark purple and orange shawl over her head. She's wearing a black mask. She has yellow sleeves, and she has a yellow apron effect garment below her waist over bright orange pants. Both of these individuals are wearing sandals with soles on them. The last person I described is holding a thermometer towards the forehead of the third person photographed. And the person holding the thermometer and also the blood oxidizer contraption is also wearing gloves. The third person, between the other two, which are probably the healthcare workers based upon what they are doing and what they are holding in their hands, is a woman. She's garbed in another beautifully fabricated sari, and I am going to be brave and call this a sari from the way the fabric is wound around her body. She's wearing a bright turquoise shirt, and one can see only the sleeve of the shirt. She has her right hand held out to accommodate this oxygen checking device, and the rest of the sari is in bright pinks and red and roses and green and yellow, and there seems to be an overall floral motif. She is not wearing a mask. However, one end of the sari is being utilized as a scarf around her nose and mouth. Returning to the text. In an attempt to stop the economic nosedive, Modi shifted his messaging in May. Corona will remain a part of our lives for a long time, he said in a televised address. But at the same time, we cannot allow our lives to be confined only around Corona. He announced a relief package worth $260 billion, about 10% of the country's GDP. But only a fraction of this came as extra handouts for the poor, with the majority instead devoted to tiding over businesses. In the televised speech announcing the package, Modi spoke repeatedly about making India a self-sufficient economy. It was this that made Prajapati lose hope of ever getting government support. Modiji said, "We have to become self-reliant," he said, still referring to the prime minister with an honorific suffix. What does that mean? That we can only depend on ourselves. The government has left us all alone. By the time the lockdown began to lift in June, Prajapati's savings had run out. His government ID card listed his village address, so he was not able to access government food rations, and he found himself struggling to buy food for his family. Three times he visited a public square, where a local nonprofit was handing out meals. On June 6, he finally left Pune for his family's village, Khajurhat. He had been forced to borrow from relatives the $76 for tickets for his wife, brother, and himself. But having heard the stories of migrants making deadly journeys back, he was thankful to have found a safe way home. Meanwhile, the virus had been spreading across India despite the lockdown. The first hotspots were India's biggest cities. In Pune, Kajanath Kali, 44, was admitted to public hospital with the virus July 4, after waiting in line for nearly 4 hours. Doctors said he needed a bed with a ventilator, but none was available. His family searched in vain for 6 days, but no hospital could provide one. July 11, he died in an ambulance on the way to a private hospital, where his family finally located a bed in an intensive care unit with a ventilator. He knew he was going to die, says Kali's wife, Sanjita, holding a framed photograph of him. He was in a lot of pain. By June, almost every day saw a record for daily confirmed cases, and as COVID-19 moved from early hotspots in cities toward rural areas of the country where healthcare facilities are less well equipped, public health experts expressed concern, noting India has only 0.55 hospital beds per 1,000 people, far below Brazil's 2.15 and the U.S.'s 2.80. Much of India's health infrastructure is only in urban areas, says Ramanan Lakshminarayanan, director of the D.C.-based Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy. As the pandemic unfolds, it's moving into states which have very low levels of testing and rural areas where the public health infrastructure is weak. When he arrived back in his village of Khajurhat, Prajapati's neighbors were worried he might have been infected in Pune, so medical workers at the district hospital checked his temperature and asked if he had any symptoms. But he was not offered a test. While testing has been getting better in India, it's still nowhere near where it needs to be, says Harvard's Jha. Nevertheless, Modi has repeatedly touted India's low case fatality rate, the number of deaths as a percentage of the number of cases, as proof that India has a handle on the pandemic. As of August 17, the rate was 1.9%, compared with 3.1% in the U.S. The average fatality rate in our country has been quite low compared to the world, and it is a matter of satisfaction that it's constantly decreasing, Modi said in a televised video conference August 11. This means our efforts are proving effective, but experts say this language is dangerously misleading. As long as your case numbers are increasing, your case fatality rate will continue to fall, Jha says. When the virus is spreading exponentially, as it is currently in India, he explains, cases increase sharply, but deaths, which lag weeks behind, stay low, skewing the ratio to make it appear a low percentage are dying. No serious public health person believes this is an important statistic. On the contrary, Jha says, it might give people false optimism, increasing the risk of transmission. Modi's move to lock down the country in March has met with a surge in approval ratings. Many Indians praised the move as strong and decisive. But while other foreign leaders' lockdown honeymoons eventually gave way to popular resentment, Modi's ratings remained stratospheric. In some recent polls, they topped 80%. The reason has much to do with his wider political project, which critics see as an attempt to turn India from a multi-faith constitutional democracy into an authoritarian Hindu supremacist state. Since winning re-election with a huge majority in May 2019, Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, the political wing of a much larger grouping of organizations whose stated mission is to turn India into a Hindu nation, has delivered on several long-held goals that excite its right-wing Hindu base, at the expense of the country's Muslim minority. Hindus make up 80% of the population and Muslims 14%. Last year, the government revoked the autonomy of India's only Muslim majority state, Kashmir. And an opulent new temple is being built in Ayodhya. Excuse me, I'll spell that. A-Y-O-D-H-Y-A. A site where many Hindus believe the deity Ram was born, and where Hindu fundamentalists destroyed a mosque in 1992. After decades of legal wrangling and political pressure from the BJP, in 2019 the Supreme Court finally ruled a temple could be built in its place. On August 5, Modi attended a televised ceremony for the laying of the foundation stone. Still, before the pandemic, Modi was facing his most severe challenge yet, in the form of a months-long nationwide protest movement. All over the country, citizens gathered at universities and public spaces, reading aloud the preamble of the Indian Constitution, quoting Mohandas Gandhi and holding aloft the Indian tricolor. The protests began in December 2019 as resistance to a controversial law that would make it harder for Muslim immigrants from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Bangladesh to gain Indian citizenship. They morphed into a wider pushback against the direction of the country under the BJP. In local Delhi elections in February, the BJP campaigned on a platform of crushing the protests, but ended up losing seats. Soon after, riots broke out in the capital. 53 people were killed, 38 of them Muslims. Hindus were also killed in the violence. Police failed to intervene to stop Hindu mobs roaming around Muslim neighborhoods looking for people to kill. And in some cases, they themselves joined mob attacks on Muslims, according to a Human Rights Watch report. During those 100 days, I thought India had changed forever, says Harsh Mander, a prominent civil rights activist and the director of the Center for Equity Studies, a Delhi think tank of the nationwide dissent from December to March. But the lockdown put an abrupt end to the protests. Since then, the government has ramped up its crackdown on dissent. In June, Delhi police, who report to Modi's interior minister, Amit Shah, accused Mander of inciting the Delhi riots. In charges against him, they quoted out of context portions of a speech he made in December, calling on protesters to continue Gandhi's legacy of nonviolent resistance, making it sound instead as if he was calling on them to be violent. Meanwhile, local BJP politician Kapil Mishra, who was filmed immediately before the riots, giving Delhi police an ultimatum to clear the streets of protesters lest his supporters do it themselves, still walks free. In my farthest imagination, I could not believe there would be this sort of repression, Mander says. A pattern was emerging. Police have also arrested at least 11 other protest leaders, including Safura Zargar, a 27-year-old Muslim student activist who organized peaceful protests. She was accused of inciting the Delhi riots and charged with murder under the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act, a harsh anti-terrorism law that authorities used at least 7 times during the lockdown to arrest activists or journalists. The law is described by Amnesty International as a tool of harassment, and by Zargar's lawyer, Ritesh Dubey, in an interview with Time, as aimed at criminalizing dissent. As COVID-19 spread around the country, Zargar was kept in jail 2 months without bail, despite being 12 weeks pregnant at the time of her arrest. Restrictions in place to curb the spread of coronavirus, like not allowing lawyers to visit prisons, have also impacted protesters' access to legal justice, Dubey says. The government used this health emergency to crush the largest popular movement this country has seen since independence, Mander says. The Indian Muslim has been turned into the enemy within. The economy has tanked. There's mass hunger. Infections are rising and rising, but none of that matters. Modi has been forgiven for everything else. This normalization of hate is almost like a drug. In the intoxication of this drug, even hunger seems acceptable. Close to going hungry, Prajapati says the Modi administration has provided little relief for people like him. If we have not gotten anything from the government, not even a sack of rice, then what can we say to them? He says, I do not have any hope from the government. Still, a change in government would be too much for Prajapati, a devout Hindu and a Modi supporter, who backs the construction of the Temple of Ram in Ayodhya and cheered on the BJP when it revoked the autonomy of Kashmir. There's no one else like Modi who we can put our faith in, he says. At least he has done some good things. Prajapati remained in Khazarat from June until August, working his family's acre of farmland where they grow rice, wheat, potatoes, and mustard. But there was little other work available, and the yield from the farm was not sufficient to support the family. Now, $267 in debt to employers and relatives, he decided to return to Pune along with his wife and brother. Worried about reports of rising cases in the city, his usually stoic father cried as he waved his son off from the village. On his journey, Prajapati carried 44 pounds of wheat and 22 pounds of rice, which he hoped would feed his family until he could find construction work. On the evening of his return, Prajapati cleaned his home, cooked dinner from what he'd carried back from the village, and began calling contractors to look for work. The pandemic had set him back at least a year, he said, and it would take him even longer to pay back the money he owed. The stamp on his hand he had received at the station, stating he was to self-quarantine for 7 days, had already faded. Prajapati was planning to work as soon as he could. Whether the lockdown continues or not, whatever happens, we have to live here and earn some money, he said. We have to find a way to survive. The plague election, that's P-L-A-G-U-E. The pandemic has changed the way we campaign, how we vote, and what we value. By Molly Ball. Illustration by Joan Wong for Time. The illustration on this page consists of three circles in which there are people. In the first circle, which is background toned in blue, it appears to be, although we see only his back, it appears to be President Trump approaching a limousine surrounded by four men in suits wearing masks. The second circle, which is in something of a sepia tone, perhaps it's supposed to be white, it's a black and white photo, shows two people seated at a table. The one whose face we see is both masked and has that clear visor over her face as well. They look like they're stuffing envelopes or counting envelopes or stacking envelopes. Behind them are several more tables, most of them unoccupied. Way in the background, I see another table with two or three people seated around it. There is no caption. And the third circle is in tones of red, and it looks like an almost empty movie theater or auditorium. There are rows of seats in the raked format, and there's one individual. Looks like a man, but I'm not sure. He's all sprawled out. He's got his legs and feet over the seat in front of him because he's the only one there. And he is wearing a mask. This is under politics. In the 2020 that might have been, nobody is sick, and politics is the center of the universe. The Democratic Party just nominated Joe Biden, his running mate, at a mid-July convention in Milwaukee, while Republicans are gearing up to renominate Donald Trump in Charlotte. At his usual rallies, Trump's pointing to the roaring economy to make his case for re-election, while Biden struggles to stir up crowds with his plea for a return to normalcy. Trump's allies continue to promote conspiracy theories about the Biden family's entanglements in Ukraine, leading increasingly desperate Democrats to push for a second impeachment in the House. Both parties are campaigning furiously across the country, knocking on millions of doors to turn out voters in November. But in the 2020 that is actually happening, the COVID-19 pandemic has changed everything, from how the campaign is conducted to how we vote to what we value. It's canceled conventions, relegated fundraising and campaigning to the digital realm, and forced many states to rapidly change how people get and submit their ballots, with unpredictable and potentially disastrous results. The acute crises have refocused the nation's attention, bringing issues like public health and economic and racial inequality to the fore, and prompting the public to revisit what characteristics it wants in its leaders. For four years, Trump has been the dominant force and inescapable fact, not only of national politics, but also of American life. Now he finds himself displaced as the central character in his own campaign by a plague that answers to no calendar, ideology, or political objective. Just as the virus has changed the way adults report to offices and children go to school, upending whole industries in the process, it has spurred a massive shift in the fundamental act of American democracy, how we select the president who will be charged with ending the pandemic's reign of destruction, dealing with its aftermath, shaping the nation that rises from its ashes. And as with so many other changes wrought by the coronavirus, the practice of American politics may never be quite the same again. This was always going to be an unusual contest, the high-stakes re-election campaign of a historically divisive president at a pivotal moment for the nation, a referendum on his norm-shattering style and disruptive vision, a test for his scattered opposition to prove which side of a polarized political spectrum represents the mainstream. As the campaign enters its final three-month stretch, Trump trails badly in national and battleground state polls as Americans give his dismal handling of the pandemic a failing grade. But the end of Trump's turbulent term will be written by the virus. It started us with its rise and spread in January and February, suspended normal life in March and April, lulled many into complacency before whipsawing us again with its resurgence in June and July. Who knows what kind of October surprise it may have in store? Like most things these days, presidential politics has adapted in ways that can get a little weird. For example, on Facebook one recent Thursday evening, Donald Trump Jr. is rhapsodizing with the aging former Chicago Bears coach Mike Ditka about childhood physical abuse. Maybe a few more kids in this country need a little bit more ass-whooping than participation medals, says Trump Jr., who wears an open-necked purple polo shirt and AirPods. Ditka, whose phone is tilted upward toward his bottle brush mustache, looks confused. "How can you say that?" he replies. "These poor kids." The broadcast, an installment of Trump Jr.'s Triggered podcast, epitomizes the content the Trump campaign is feeding hungry supporters online. On another recent evening, it hosted The Right View, in which Trump Jr.'s girlfriend, Kimberly Guilfoyle, Eric Trump's wife, Laura, and Trump campaign aides Mercedes Schlapp and Katrina Pearson laud the debunked virtues of hydroxychloroquine as a COVID treatment in a segment that will eventually rack up more than 500,000 views on Facebook. The campaign was already creating such online content, but it's newly central in the world, where rallies risk becoming super spreader events. The Biden campaign has also moved online, where its presence, like its candidate, is more sedate and traditional. Events are advertised to local supporters and organized around constituency groups or issues, just as they would be in a normal campaign. Biden's wife Jill appears via Zoom at a virtual campaign stop with the mayor of West Palm Beach, Florida, to talk about his plans for seniors. Former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams hosts an online racial and economic justice roundtable with business owners in Detroit. Biden himself joins his former running mate, Barack Obama, for a stagey 15-minute conversation about the Trump administration's failures. Despite the pandemic, Trump had hoped to keep up the rally central to his political mythology, but an attempted return to the stage in Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 20, turned into a debacle, with a sparse, mostly maskless crowd that barely filled the bottom deck of the indoor arena. Lately, he has settled for online tele-rallies, glorified conference calls that Trump supporters in key states are invited to tune in to a couple of times a week. At a recent one targeting voters in Maine and New Hampshire, Trump dutifully shouts out the local Republican candidates, extols lobster fishermen, and vows to get tough on Canadian currency manipulation. Almost 13,000 people are listening live, and hundreds of thousands more will eventually view the half-hour audio stream. The future of our nation will be defined by patriots who love our country and want to build it up and make it bigger and better and stronger, or it will be defined by the radical left. And usually, radical left Democrats are left-wing extremists who hate our country, he intones. In person, this kind of line would draw a roar from Trump's throngs of admirers, but online, the only feedback is the silent scroll of Facebook comments. Trump's political advisor, Jason Miller, says tele-rallies have been a hit. The genius of Donald Trump is he knows how to foster and build one-on-one relationships with his voters, he says. But it is clear the virtual gatherings are no substitute for the real thing. Lacking his usual source of mass adulation, the president has taken to touting the crowds that line the streets when he visits various states on official business. Some local candidates, many Republicans, are still holding in-person events despite the risks. But the pandemic has become a vector for partisan attacks. When a GOP Senate candidate in Virginia posted a video of himself attending an indoor political event without a mask, the state Democratic Party seized on the image to call him dangerously irresponsible. Many state Democratic parties have chosen to hold all virtual conventions, but several of their GOP counterparts have tried to blaze ahead. The Republican Party of Texas took its case all the way to the Supreme Court, which sided with the Houston mayor, who had canceled its in-person convention. The hastily assembled virtual confab that ensued featured extensive technical difficulties. At one point, Texas Monthly reported, pranksters invaded an online planning document and added pee-pee-poo-poo to the schedule, and by the end, angry delegates ousted the state chairman. It has been a similar story at the national level. Democrats decided early on that the planned July convention in Milwaukee would not be feasible. It was pushed back to mid-August and radically scaled down, with delegates staying home and voting remotely, and Biden himself staying away. The GOP has had a bumpier road. In June, Trump moved the convention from Charlotte, North Carolina, to Jacksonville, Florida, in a fit of pique over the North Carolina Democratic governor's insistence on safety protocols. As Florida's COVID-19 caseload surged this summer, party officials made a series of frantic adjustments, culminating in a last-ditch effort to hold the festivities in an outdoor stadium in the August heat. Finally, in late July, Trump announced the Jacksonville program would be scotched. The current plan, which is still being developed, is to hold a small number of party meetings in North Carolina and have the president accept the nomination with a televised speech at a location to be determined. Again, I will remind you that this article was written for an August 17 to 24 edition. The lack of traditional conventions is perhaps not such a loss. Events where party insiders in smoke-filled rooms once actually picked presidential nominees and running mates have become, in the modern era, little more than infomercials. But they serve as a major engine of the party's fundraising, another operation that's moved online in the age of coronavirus. The swanky catered affairs that donors once paid tens of thousands of dollars per plate to attend are now BYOB live streams. Campaigns have had to get creative as the novelty fades. When the stay-at-home orders started, campaigns immediately started doing virtual events, a Zoom fundraiser, a field organizer hangout, says Brian Krebs, who works at a Democratic digital campaign firm called Rising Tide Interactive. But the bar is rising now that a lot of people are Zoomed out. You have got to have a special guest or some kind of hook. People are not going to show up if it's just 12 squares talking. On the other hand, celebrity guests can be easier to land when they can appear at your fundraiser without leaving L.A. The Texas Democratic Senate nominee, M.J. Heger, recently recorded an event with the cast of Supernatural, and New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, none of whom set foot in Texas. Hegar, that's spelled H-E-G-A-R. Campaign volunteers have also gotten creative with their outreach, holding a voter registration texting session that doubled as a Taylor Swift listening party. Around this time in an election, campaigns traditionally shift from registering, identifying, and persuading voters to pushing them to the polls. The GOP is still doing so, knocking on a million doors a week, the Republican National Committee claims. But on the left, an intense debate has broken out about the ethics of going door to door amid a plague. Plague, that is. Research suggests that in-person conversations with voters are the most effective way to get them to turn out. But most liberal groups and the Biden campaign are not planning on door knocking this year, viewing it as too risky for workers and voters alike. One group that forged ahead, the Progressive Turnout Project, had to suspend its operations in a dozen states after several employees tested positive for COVID-19. The irony is more Americans are eager for political engagement this year. In a Fox News poll in July, 85% said they were extremely or very motivated to vote, and the percentage of respondents who told Gallup they were more enthusiastic than usual about voting was up 10 points from 2016. Despite the difficulties of pandemic voting, primaries in states such as Texas and Georgia have set turnout records. At the same time, new voter registrations have plummeted because of the closure of government offices, like departments of motor vehicles. and Pinal County, Arizona, a small progressive organization called Rural Arizona Engagement had gotten only a quarter of the way to its voter registration goal when it had to stop canvassing in March. Attempts to continue the work by phone were mostly unsuccessful. Even though Arizona is currently a coronavirus hotspot, the group hopes to go back into the field to turn out the vote. We feel like if we can follow Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines and train our staff in a way that protects them and the people we are talking to, this is a year that requires this work to be done, says the group's co-executive director, Natalie Fierro-Spock. The pandemic, she says, has heightened people's awareness of why their vote matters. It has also increased canvassers' success rate. With so many people isolated in their homes, more are willing to answer the door and talk with a stranger. Despite robust public support for wearing masks, the Pinal County Board of Supervisors decided against a mask mandate for businesses, and the rabble-rousing county sheriff, Mark Lamb, announced he would not enforce the state's stay-at-home order. Lamb was forced to cancel a planned appearance with Trump at the White House when he was diagnosed with COVID-19 in June. People are starting to connect the dots, Fierro-Spock says, and consider who is serving in these local offices and how much power they wield. The pandemic landed in the midst of America's primary election season, forcing state election officials to adapt on the fly. The results offer a glimpse of the massive challenges the general election will pose and the disasters that could ensue. One of the first test runs came in Ohio, whose primary was scheduled for March 17, just days after the World Health Organization declared a global pandemic. The NBA abruptly suspended its season, and states across the country began rapidly shutting down. When Republican Governor Mike DeWine sought to delay the primary, some candidates sued, and courts ruled he did not have the power to do so. Finally, at 4 a.m. on election day, with workers already starting to set up for balloting, the Ohio Supreme Court ruled the state's health director could order the polls closed as an emergency measure. But the GOP-controlled legislature would not go along with DeWine's proposal to move the vote to June, so a mail-only election with an April 28 deadline was held instead. Other states soon had their own experiences with the logistical, constitutional, and political complexities of pandemic voting. In Wisconsin's April 7 primary, held on schedule after a last-minute standoff between its Democratic governor and Republican legislature, hundreds of polling locations were forced to close when poll workers, fearful for their safety, declined to show up. Hundreds of thousands of voters still turned out, standing in socially distanced lines for hours to cast their ballots. One scientific study later tied the election to a surge in COVID-19 cases, though other researchers disagreed with that assessment. Georgia's June 9 primary melted down amid short staffing and technical problems, leading to endless lines and significant disenfranchisement that Democrats charged was an intentional bid by GOP officials to suppress the vote. In New York, a state that normally votes almost entirely in person, election officials blame an unprecedented flood of absentee ballots for the fact that more than a month after the June 23 election, they had not declared a winner in some contests. In each case, the coronavirus struck at a system that was already fragile. It is a mistake to think of the pandemic as something separate from other problems with our election systems, says Rick Hazen, an election law expert at the University of California, Irvine. It interacts with the existing pathologies to make things worse. Hazen's most recent book, Election Meltdown, was published February 4, the day after the calamitous Iowa Democratic caucuses, whose delayed results illustrated the problems bulky election infrastructure can produce, even without a worldwide pandemic. Many states that have been administering elections in person for decades are now attempting to pivot to mail voting, allowing people to vote absentee without any excuse or by citing COVID-19 as a legitimate medical reason. But not all. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a Democratic lawsuit that sought to allow all Texas voters to choose mail ballots. In Georgia, the GOP Secretary of State mailed every voter a ballot application for the primary, but will not do so for the general election. I think it is because there was a historic turnout, particularly among Democratic primary voters, and Republicans do not want to encourage that in the general election, says N.C. Ufot, executive director of the New Georgia Project. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.